Hi, folks. This is Jerry Booth. Vermonters drink Booth Brothers milk every day. They know they can trust Booth Brothers for great-tasting milk with no artificial growth hormones. It's local, it's fresh, it's healthy, and it's produced right here in central Vermont. In a world that's constantly changing, it's good to know where your milk comes from. 27 local farms with the same goal, only the freshest, the finest Booth Brothers milk. So the next time you're in a dairy aisle, reach for Booth Brothers.
It's time to get the story behind the story. Interviews with newsmakers, newsbreakers, and your phone calls. Radio Vermont presents The Mark Johnson Show.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the program. Thanks for tuning in. Medium rain out there today. Thanks for spending part of your morning with us. We're going to get right down to business. Coming up later this hour, it'll be quite a contrast to our next discussion, but we're going to be joined later this hour by comedian Paula Poundstone, who's going to be making an appearance here in Vermont. So we'll talk all about that. We'll be taking your phone calls throughout the program. Love to hear from you at 244-1777. That's our local number in central Vermont. You can also reach us on our toll-free lines at 877-291-8255. What an honor. Joining us live on the line this morning, let's give a nice warm Radio Vermont welcome this morning to Andrew Solomon, who's a writer and lecturer on psychology, politics, and the arts. He's the winner of a National Book Award. He's been an activist in the gay and lesbian community and also mental health issues as well as the arts. He writes incredibly eloquently and speaks quite eloquently about issues involving depression, identity, the importance of friendship, and just the importance of us all being on this planet together. Andrew, thank you very much for joining us. How are you this morning?
I'm very well. What a pleasure to be here.
Well, you know, the reason I first contacted you is I lost a very good friend to depression who committed suicide, and somebody suggested that you would be somebody who knows an enormous amount about this issue, which you do. You've suffered from depression. You've interviewed hundreds, if not thousands, of people who suffered from it. I was really struck by an observation you made that said that the opposite of depression is not happiness. Can you start there for us?
Sure. Well, in the first place, my sincere condolences on the loss of your friend. It's terrible to lose anyone that you love, and to lose anyone you love to suicide is, I think, always the hardest and saddest thing that there is. In talking about depression as not the opposite of happiness, what I've said is the opposite of depression is not happiness, but vitality. And what I mean by that is that people tend to think when you're depressed, you feel very sad, because we often use the word depressed as a descriptor for extreme sadness. But clinical depression, while it may contain elements of extreme and unconnected sadness floating around, what it mostly entails is this complete loss of vitality, of the energy and the will to live, the sense that everything is difficult, everything is burdensome, everything is overwhelming, that getting out of bed and getting dressed and going out onto the street is more than you can handle, that eating food is an enormous burden, that all interactions are difficult. It's that sense of losing all of the force that ordinarily motivates your life.
And you say the grip of it is incredibly powerful. Talk about that.
Well, I think when you haven't actually experienced it, or sometimes even if you have experienced it but aren't experiencing right now, it's difficult to understand how acute and how physical it is. You know, people will say to me, well, I sometimes have a difficult day and I just don't feel like getting up, but I find if I just push myself and I get out of bed, then I go on and everything's okay. And you have to explain to them, no, it's a profound problem. It's a biological problem. It's an utterly disabling, paralyzing thing. And when you're in it, the sense of inability, it isn't, I don't feel like doing this or I don't want to do this. It's, I can't do this. And you really can't. Something is going on in your brain that is making ordinary things completely impossible. And you can sort of try to think your way out of it all you want. You can't do it. You're in an agonizing syndrome of paralysis.
But you say you also know that it's, quote, ridiculous while it's happening.
Yes, because you think to yourself, come on, all I have to do today is get up and get dressed and go to work, or all I have to do is go across my apartment and get some food out and make myself a sandwich for lunch. And you know that people do that all the time, that most people do that without even thinking about it, day after day, week after week. And yet when you're in the depression, you just feel like you can't do it, and you think, this is ludicrous. How can I be unable to do this thing that absolutely everyone else manages to do just fine? But even though you know it's ridiculous, you also know that it's true.
We're talking with author and lecturer Andrew Solomon. You can join us at 244-1777, toll-free 877-291-8255. You found, you went out and interviewed people across the world on depression and found that this is not, as you describe it, not a middle-class modern disease of the Western world. How pervasive is depression, Andrew?
I think there tends to be a misapprehension somehow that depression is mostly something that happens to modern middle class people who have the leisure for it. And what I found, in fact, is that it's existed across history. Hippocrates described depression 2,500 years ago with almost exactly the same language that you would find in the DSM, the sort of psychiatry books of today. I found that it has existed across cultures. I went and looked at depression among the Greenlandic Inuit. I looked at depression among survivors of the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia, and I looked at tribal rituals for the treatment of depression in West Africa. And I also found that it exists across the class spectrum. And there, the sort of confusing thing is that people who basically have a really nice life and feel completely miserable recognize that there's something wrong with them. And many of them, at least, are likely to go to a doctor and say, I don't know why I feel this way. I must have some sort of mental illness. While people who are living at the bottom of the social ladder, who feel terrible all the time, think that the way they feel is commensurate with what their lives are like and that they feel so bad because they have such bleak lives. Mm-hmm. But often I found when I went into those communities, it's not that they're depressed because they have bleak lives, but rather that they have bleak lives because they're too depressed to be able to fix the things that make their lives so bleak, and that depression is very underdiagnosed in impoverished communities.
So this is all biological.
I think that's kind of an artificial construction. I think everything is biological, and I think everything is experiential. So I'm having an experience of being on this radio program and trying to snap into some state of coherence. There are biological correlates of that, even though it's an experiential thing. I think your brain is changed by the experiences you have. So when our scanning techniques get to be a lot better, we'll be able to see where a college education is lodged in someone's brain, or where a childhood of bullying is lodged in someone's brain, and so on and so forth. I think they're two different vocabularies for talking about the same set of problems. And I think when you look at depression, you know, for some people it seems to come out of nowhere, and for some people it seems to be tied to experience. But once it takes off, it's probably a series of biological processes, which we still don't understand as coherently as we should. And it needs to be addressed both in terms of the person's lived experience, what's going on experientially, and in terms of the biology of their brain, insofar as we can reach it directly.
All right. So there can be what you, as you describe it, these triggering circumstances that happen.
Well, I think there are almost always triggering circumstances that start an initial episode of depression. Someone who's very vulnerable to depression needs only a very slight triggering circumstance. They have a bad day, it's raining, they lose their job, something goes wrong that is upsetting to them and pushes them over into a really major depression. Some people are much more resilient, but if you expose them to a big enough trauma, it will trigger the depression. The first episode is usually linked, and not always, to a trigger. Later episodes, once the depression, which is a cyclic condition, really sets in, those later episodes frequently seem to come out of nowhere.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any sense why this is so pervasive?
I think that's an evolutionary question. You know, why is it so pervasive? I mean, it's diagnosed a lot more often now than it used to be, and I think there are a lot of reasons for that. I think modern life is very hectic. I think that people are overwhelmed. I think they spend a lot of time interacting with screens instead of interacting with other human beings. Well, that's a problem. I think our population is very underslept. The amount we sleep went down with the invention of electric light, went down again with the invention of TV, and has gone down again with the advent of the internet. So I think there are all of those things out there. But I think ultimately that it's very, very useful for human beings to have a mood spectrum. It's very useful to be able to experience joy and sadness and anger and jealousy and frustration. Those are all mood states that help to motivate basic human behavior. But to have a mood spectrum that's as complicated as that is to invite the possibility that at some point the moods will go wrong. And I think depression represents a sort of breakdown of what should be a mood spectrum that doesn't extend as far as that. And I think with something as complicated as moods and as human psychology, it's almost inevitable that there will be vulnerability to things going wrong.
Wow. We're talking with author and lecturer Andrew Solomon. You got out of your depression in part by taking medication, but you asked a really interesting question, which is, did the medication make you more of yourself or somebody else? What did you finally figure out on that?
I mean, I think that's a very profound question. And when I was working on the book I wrote about depression, The Noonday Demon, I really talked to an awful lot of people about that question. And I think there's some of each. I think essentially most of what the medication does is to take away the sort of blockade of symptoms that are lying on top of someone's underlying personality. But I think the experience of being someone whose mental health is to some degree contingent on taking pills every day is a real shift in identity and a real shift in who you are. So even if the drugs aren't making you into someone else, the fact that you're taking them forces you to reconsider who you are, to reconsider what your brain is, to think about how your own psychology works and functions or fails to work and function. So I think it's some of each.
You also wrote, after this study came out in Great Britain, that talked about how 1 in 10 people lacked one, even one close friend, that 1 in 10 also felt unloved in the past 2 weeks. Did those numbers surprise you?
I've become aware since I published this book of how many lonely people there are out there. I have a website at andrewsolomon.com, and I get a huge amount of correspondence from people who write and who seem not to have any human being supporting them. So I knew there was a lot of that out there. And I think that depression is a disease of loneliness. And I think part of the reason it's been on the upswing is that we live in a society in which it's easy for people to be very isolated, to have very limited interaction with other human beings, to be cut off from emotional bonds. But the 1 in 10 number that came through in that rigorous study in Britain was nonetheless really shocking to me, that there are that many people who have no friends. And in the same study, they discovered that a full half of the people they talked to said that they felt they hadn't been able to have a meaningful, intimate conversation in the last 2 weeks. And I thought, even if those people say that they have some friends, that's still a lonely, lonely way to be living. It made me very sad.
Yeah. So what do you think's going on with that? Why is that happening? We live in this incredibly connected world, and people feel so unconnected.
I think that to some extent people feel unconnected because we live in this very connected world. I mean, I think that there has been a tendency to mistake the kind of ambient intimacy of Facebook sort of chat sites and so on for the real intimacy that comes of interacting with another human being. And I think we've had a breakdown of community. You know, there was a time when people were pulled into the community of their church or their synagogue or their mosque, when people were pulled into a sense of community because the workplace was a sociable workplace, when people had to have a lot of contact. And I think now there are a lot of people who have jobs that mostly involve sitting behind a computer and who don't interact much with others. And I think we've lost a lot of those institutions. They don't have to be religious ones, so we've lost a lot of the civic institutions that used to bring people together. I just think it's easier to fall through the cracks than it used to be.
Mm-hmm. What are the civic organizations? What do you mean? I mean, church, you mentioned. What else?
Well, I think people used to form deeper bonds when school was more structured, and they went through that. I think if you lived in a small town 100 years ago, there were people in the town who noticed if you never came out of your house and went over to see what was wrong. I think now it's very easy to be completely cut off from sociability with your neighbors or the people around you. I think people used to gather around cultural events of various kinds. You know, it's a social thing to go, I don't know, even to Even to the movies tended to be sort of more of a social thing. Now people are getting their movies from Netflix and watching them at home. I just think people, not all people, but some people are able to spend much more time alone than they used to.
Mm-hmm. You talk about how the stories of our life are the foundation of our identity. Do people who have adversity in their life have more happiness, or do people who that don't have adversity in their life have more happiness?
It's hard to measure happiness. You know, you can't get a scale and see sort of who has the most of it. What I've been interested in all of my work, and especially in my last book, which was Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity, is the question of resilience, which is to say, understanding why some people faced with very difficult experiences, they're depressed, their children have disabilities, any of a broad range of other difficult experiences, why some people in the face of those things fall to pieces, and other people in the face of those things manage to find meaning in their experiences and to build positive and constructive identities. And my finding is that obviously none of us would opt for painful experiences we could avoid. You know, you wouldn't say, gee, I've really missed out by never experiencing major clinical depression. I mean, that's not something you'd be after. Far From the Tree looks at these families of children with various kinds of differences and disabilities and challenges, and, you know, nobody wants those things for their children. But there are people who, having had those experiences that they wouldn't have wanted, feel that having them has made them look at their lives more deeply and find meaning in them. I mean, I think of family I interviewed who have a child with Down syndrome and who got very involved and really devoted their lives to changing the way people with Down syndrome are educated in the U.S. and now to some extent internationally. And I said, do you wish it had never happened? Do you wish your child didn't have Down syndrome? Do you wish you could make it go away? And Karen Robarts, the mother, said to me, well, for our son David, I wish I could make it go away, because for David it's a difficult way to live and I'd like to give him an easier life. She said, but speaking for myself, well, I would never have believed 30 years ago when he was born that I could come to such a point. I have. For David, I wouldn't give up these experiences. I would give up these experiences in an instant, but speaking for myself, it's given me so much more purposeful and so much more engaged to life that I wouldn't exchange these experiences for anything in the world. And I think people become attached to their own lives and the narratives of their own lives, and that's really my topic.
Well, and you could make the same claim. I mean, your depression gave you more insight into human nature and what we're all about.
Yes, I think it gave me some humility. It gave me some empathy. It gave me an understanding of what it's like to feel helpless, which was not a way that I had mostly felt prior to that. I think it made me a kinder, more empathetic person, and certainly a better writer. Now, if you said to me, would you like to have another depression and learn that all over again? I would say, no, thank you. I've learned as much as I need to, and I'd like to leave that well and truly behind. But, you know, I remember talking to one of the mothers in the course of doing the Far From the Tree book, and she said to me, people always give us these little sayings, like God doesn't give you any more than you can handle.
Mm-hmm.
But children like ours are not preordained as a gift. They're a gift because that's what we have chosen. And I feel like people make those choices over and over and over again. So would I have chosen to be depressed? Probably not. But having been through it and by and large come out the other side, though it still takes managing and dealing with, do I feel those experiences were valuable? Yes, I feel they were very valuable.
How close did you ever come to taking your life?
You know, I thought about it, as people who are depressed do, but I was never really acutely suicidal. I had moments of thinking, oh, I wish I could get sick. If I could have died by doing nothing, then I think I would have just curled up in a corner and died. But dying, actually, or suicide, takes a lot of effort. It takes a certain amount of impulsiveness. It entails a certain amount of violence, and those weren't the things that I was at. But having felt as bad as I did, I understand why it is that other people who feel that way do decide to kill themselves.
If somebody listening to this were struggling, what would you say to them?
The first thing I would say is that depression is a treatable condition. There are medications that can be helpful. There are certain kinds of psychotherapy, such as cognitive behavioral therapy, that can make an enormous difference. I would say don't just sit there and suffer. Go and seek out that help. I would say that there are a variety of behavioral changes that can make a difference. Exercise makes a huge difference for people who are depressed. Regularizing your sleep and eating, avoiding alcohol, caffeine to some degree, and substances of abuse in general will all make a difference. And I would also say that people use up a lot of energy being ashamed of the fact that they're depressed. And there are all kinds of social reasons why that happens. But depression is a disease of loneliness, and try to find someone you can tell about it so that you aren't alone in that experience. And you will be surprised that most people, not all people, but most people, if you tell them that you've experienced depression, will say, "Oh my God, so did my sister," or "I had an episode a few years ago, it was terrible," or "I'm so worried about my kid." It's amazing that people are trying to keep this secret given how ubiquitous it is.
God, isn't it? It is amazing once that happens, the number of people that come out. I felt some frustration, I will be candid with you, for a short period of time with my friend who killed herself. And, you know, I didn't feel that total compassion for a period of time. What would you say to me?
I think it's difficult to feel compassion. I think one always feels betrayed. I have a good friend who killed himself. Now it's probably 7 or 8 years ago, but I remember having that feeling of sort of, well, if he had explained what was going on, we could have helped. We didn't really understand what was going on. That sense that there were always other options, and that sense that he had caused so much sadness and so much pain and so many people whom he left behind. But then I started reading some of his journal entries, which I was given access to by his survivors, and I realized that he had a completely distorted sense of reality, and he genuinely believed that there was no one who actually cared about him, that nobody would miss him if he was gone, that there would be no mourning, and that he would not leave a gap in the world. And also, as I read it, I realized the intensity of his psychic pain, how strong it was and how persistent it was, and how helpless he felt in the clutches of it. So, you know, I think people mostly feel angry or betrayed or a variety of other negative emotions when somebody kills themselves, but I think, or herself. But I think over time, if you really are able to get into the psyche of the person who did it, you can see that it was, you know, people are not killing themselves because they think it's fun and funny. They're doing it out of a sense of impossible despair.
I think I also felt great fear, because if it could take this person, who I viewed as being somebody very strong, that it could get anybody.
After Robin Williams' suicide, I got all kinds of calls from people asking me to comment on what had happened. And I wrote a piece for the New Yorker blog about it, but that was part of what I said. The reason people are so troubled and frustrated by a story like that is that you think, okay, if you could be Robin Williams and kill yourself, then it could happen to any of us. And I feel like it could. And having said that, I don't think I've ever been really acutely suicidal. You know, I sometimes think to myself, but what if that happened to me? What if my thinking headed off in that direction? And I hope it won't, and I hope the fact that I think about it will help me to defend against it. But I know it could happen. I could do it, and so could any of the people I really love.
Last question. Thank you for being so generous with your time, too. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
In all of what we've talked about here, I want to sort of boil this down to a last question here, which is, why are we so incredibly tough on ourselves? And what have you found in all the travels, all the interviews you've done, are the obstacles to happiness?
Well, I think one of the obstacles to happiness is that we have a very distorted sense of what our lives should be like. There was a lot of stuff in the kind of feminist press of the 70s and 80s talking about how supermodels made women feel bad about their bodies, their sort of normal bodies that weren't supermodel bodies. And I think there's been a very similar process through which a kind of psychological supermodel that's projected by the media and that's part of the cult of celebrity makes people think that we should feel wonderful and happy all the time. And when we don't feel completely happy and when our lives aren't in perfect order, we're not only sad endemically because that's the condition, but we also feel like we've failed. And I think that sense of failure often poisons people's lives. And I think an exaggerated or extreme notion of what constitutes success success, not just professionally, but professionally in one's relationship with a spouse, in one's relationship with one's children, in one's social enterprise, in one's socioeconomic or financial status. In all of these areas, we have these very high ideas of what it means to be successful. And people are vulnerable, and success is a variable quantity, and people should be more gentle, I think. I mean, you use the word tough on themselves. I think people are often too tough on themselves. Sometimes, of course, people are not tough enough on themselves, and they don't do what they could. But I think a lot of the time we have an exaggerated notion of what our lives should be like, and that our sense that we've somehow failed to accomplish that drives us into unnecessary despair.
How can we be kinder to ourselves, then?
Well, I think by thinking through these issues, by being awake to that reality, by saying to ourselves, when we have a moment of vulnerability or a moment of sadness or a moment when things seem to be going terribly wrong, to say this is the human experience. You know, I think it's represented in art and literature. I've certainly tried to write about it in my books, which I hope are helpful to people. People have written to me and said that they are. But I think we need just to recognize that human beings are frail, and to operate from that assumption instead of operating from the assumption that we should all be Superman and Superwoman.
And sometimes you just got to hang on.
Exactly.
Thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate it very much.
It's been a complete pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Andrew Solomon, a writer, a lecturer. He writes about psychology, politics, and the arts, winner of the National Book Award. He, his latest book, as you already mentioned, Far From the Tree, which talks about identity. All right, we're going to take a short commercial break here. We'll be back right after these important announcements.
Pat, Pat, I'm voting for Pat. Paid for a brighter picture with Pat. For jobs and better training and safe communities. Let's you keep your money with smart tax policy. United under a common goal of opportunity. That's why I'm voting for Pat. For better education and efficient government. Improve our infrastructure, higher rates of employment. For affordable healthcare and effective safety net. That's why I'm voting for Pat. Pat, Pat, I'm voting for Pat. Paint Vermont a brighter picture with Pat. Paint Vermont a brighter picture with Pat.
I'm Pat McDonald, and this ad is paid for by Pat for Vermont Senate.
They're headed your way. They're getting closer. They're here. The Walking Dead, instant tickets from the Vermont Lottery. Fend off the dead and you could walk away with $5,000 cash. And with 10 chances to win, you'd better scratch them before they scratch you. Play the Walking Dead instant tickets today. At $2, it won't cost you an arm and a leg. Please play responsibly. The Walking Dead returns Sunday, October 12th at 9, 8 Central, only on AMC.
Attention Vermonters, would you like a different vehicle but don't think your trade is worth much? Then you need to check out the Cash for Junkers event at the new McMahon Chevy Buick in Morrisville. Hi, this is Steve Sace from McMahon.
And I'm Ed Dever, sales manager at McMahon. With Cash for Junkers, if your trade rolls, floats, or